I'm going to tell you about some results that we obtained regarding knots, and some of the people who contributed to this, Andrea Sanke, Roya Zandi, are currently as part of our program at KITT. Yakov Kantor was here earlier. So I will very briefly tell you some introduction to knots and polymers, then suggest why knots in a variety of circumstances due to physical considerations will be tight objects, like the one that I have indicated for you up here, and then go to some less well-defined questions, like estimating the size of knots in open polymers, and then end up by talking about knots in proteins, and that's an interesting and rare ensemble. So knots have fascinated mankind throughout history. There's the story of Alexander and the Gordian knot, and there are lots of collections of things about artists drawing different forms of knots, and there's a reason why I stopped on this picture with the trefoil smoke ring, because there is some involvement of physicists thinking about knots that will involve smoke rings. I will come to knots and defining them more rigorously a little bit further, but very roughly you would say that as long as you have a string that is closed on itself, then there is a topological quantity, either it's like a ring or it has some kind of a knot in it. And in nature, there are long molecules that are string-like polymers. And so you would expect that these polymers could, in principle, have knots in them. And indeed, that's the case. And one of the few things that we know for sure is that if you go to a sufficiently long polymer, it will almost surely have a knot in it. But the mathematical theorems don't tell you how big this sufficiently long is. But it's also interesting that while we know for sure that a sufficiently long polymer will have knots in it, if you go and look through books that derive properties of polymers, you will seldom see any mention of knots, because they are, again, very hard to do. And typically, in dealing with self-avoiding polymers, you start expanding around four dimensions where there are no knots. Now, in real three-dimensional worlds, there are not only synthetic polymers, but also natural long polymers that are very common in biology. And certainly, knots do occur in the most important molecule, which is DNA. And there are actually enzymes that actively manipulate and try to remove knots in DNA so that it can be easily replicated. I will also end my seminar later by talking about knots in proteins, and there are some interesting examples of some such knots. Now, one of the things that you would like to do is to classify different types of knots, and the story of looking at the types of knots and classifying them actually starts with the work of three Scottish mathematical physicists that are very well known. Thomson, who became later Lord Kelvin, Maxwell, and Tate. Tate is less known than the others. And basically, it goes back, actually I have a better version of this offline, to some suggestions of Helmholtz, who was thinking about fluids around 1850. And he sort of noticed that in fluids, you could have vortex links. And somehow these vortex links have to be things that close on themselves. And the material that is inside of these vortex tubes is always there. And so he makes an interesting statement that if you make two rings, smoke rings, if they both have the same direction of rotation, they will proceed in the same sense. And the ring in front will enlarge itself and move slower, while the second one will shrink and move faster. If the velocities are not too different, the second one will finally reach the first one, pass through it, and then the whole thing repeats again and again. And I remember having done a demonstration of this when I was an undergraduate, in which you take a shoebox and you put smoke in it and you make a hole at one end, and when you tap on it, you get these smoke rings that go out. And apparently, one of the first people who did this experiment is Tate. So Tate goes and shows this experiment to Thompson, who becomes excited. A few days ago, Tate showed me in Edinburgh a magnificent way of producing rings. You sometimes can make one ring shoot with another, illustrating perfectly Helmholtz's description. When one ring passes near another, each is disturbed and is seen to be in a state of violate vibration. And this is a beautiful subject for mathematical work. Now, very shortly after seeing this, then Thompson came across the idea that maybe you could think of different elements and atoms as being different types of rings and vortex rings that you have in ether. And so he wrote actually an article shortly on smoke rings and atoms, and says that Lucretius's atom does not explain any of the properties of matter. Without attributing them to the atom itself, the possibility of founding a theory of elastic solids and liquids on dynamics of closely packed vortex atoms is reasonably anticipated. So of course, then all of that, I think, went to the wayside until about 10, 20 years ago, maybe resurrected as string theory. Okay, so that was Tate's contribution, and Maxwell, of course, at the time was thinking about electromagnetism, mutual inductances, etc. And so he discovered the formula, the integral formula for calculating the linking number between two closed curves. Apparently, Gauss had discovered this before, but Maxwell was the person who wrote the formula and published. So what Tate did was he got excited about this idea that Thompson had about the possibility of classifying the different elements and atoms. And so he decided to go and make a table of elements. So he went and classified all of the different knots that he could think of based on the following criterion that he still used today, which is the minimal number of intersections that you have in a projection to two dimensions. So that's a topological invariant. You take a loop in three dimension that has a trefoil knot in it, and you project it in two dimension. You can smooth it out, but you can't ever get rid of less than three of these crossings. So this minimal crossing is an indicator of the type of knot. Trefoil is the only one with three. There is one with four square knots. There's two with five, and it goes on. And actually, in a paper that he published in 1876, Tate goes and calculates all of the different possible knots up to seven crossings. And that should come up shortly. The first seven orders of knottiness. And so this is one page of many pages that he has in his article. And so he actually discovered a lot of ways to sort of go even further. But again, somebody was asking me, did anybody go and check these things? They're all correct. He didn't miss anything. Okay. So as opposed to these things that Tate classified as prime types of knots, the other type you could do is you could, for example, take two trefoils, put them side by side, cut them and join them and glue them together, and then what you've created is a composite knot because it has two prime elements. So this one you would label as 3-1, 3-1. Now, going back to the idea of Maxwell, that he had an integral formulation of figuring out whether loops are linked or not, the interesting question is, I give you a closed curve in three dimensions. It presumably could potentially be arbitrarily complicated. Can you figure out which one of these different topological units it corresponds to? So that's the question of figuring out knot invariance. It has been around also for a long time. And Alexander in 1923 proposed an algorithm that essentially you take the complicated knot in three dimension, project it in two dimension, and associate various factors to the points where they cross, which could be many in number, not necessarily these minimal numbers. And then there's a determinant of something that you can form based on those crossings, and that is supposed to tell you which one of these knots they are. And it works quite well, but not uniquely. If you go to sufficiently large number of crossings, I think of the order of 9 and 10, you start to get repeats. That is, the polynomial that you would calculate would not be able to distinguish between something with many crossings and, let's say, something that is fewer. So people have been trying to develop more complicated knots, etc. And so there is a well-developed branch of mathematics dealing with these knots. For purposes of what I'm going to talk about, you are never going to encounter any knots that are that complicated that the Alexander polynomial fails. So in all of the things that you will hear from me from now on, whenever we need to classify knots, we use the Alexander polynomial. Now, there's actually another way in which mathematicians try to classify the different types of knots, and it goes under the name of ideal knot. So the idea is the following. Suppose you have this string. Think of it as being composed of monomers that are interacting with each other, and you want to figure out what the minimal energy is if I specify the interaction. And actually, there is a book on ideal knots, and there is a quote from one of the mathematicians there. Suppose you have a knotted loop on a string, and you spread an electric charge along the string and let it go. What will happen? What kind of minimal energy will it get? This question has been a common cocktail party topic among knot theorists for many years. And again, I lost my. Okay. And actually, when you go and look at these knot theory papers dealing with this, you find that they have a very strange idea of what charges interacting with each other is. Because the potential that they use is 1 over r squared and not 1 over r, which we would recognize as Coulomb potential. Now, the reason for that becomes apparent when you ask this question exactly for the Coulomb potential. And you may think that because all of the monomers are repelling each other, the shape that minimizes the energy is a nice, for example, in the case of trefoil, expanded entity such as the one that I started here. But in reality, when you go and minimize the energy, you get something like this. Well, the whole thing becomes tight. And maybe your first reaction is going to be over here. You put a lot of charges that don't like each other right on top of each other. Why would the system do that to minimize its energy? The reason is that putting all of these things together at this point allows all the other monomers to spread out and get further from each other. And if you go to long enough polymers, the number of interactions that you get from all the other guys is of the order of n squared, whereas the number that you're losing over here who are very unhappy is maybe of the order of 1. So the point is that if you go to a sufficiently long polymer, if you have this kind of 1 over r Coulomb interaction, it will essentially create for you a very tight knot. And that's actually also the reason why the mathematicians don't like 1 over r. Yes? Yes, I'll come shortly to Kant. Yes. Because we will maintain some semblance of physics after all. Okay, but just before I go to that answer to your question, just to show you that this is not unique to the trefoil, that any prime knot that you try to minimize this procedure, no matter how complicated, will give you this type configuration. And interestingly, if you start with the composite knots, they actually become factorized by the Coulomb interaction minimum. Now, what Spiros was asking is that in reality, you have charges are immediately surrounded by countercharges, that will make the interaction not fall off as 1 over r forever, but there is a typical screening length. And so the argument that I gave you before, relying so heavily on the gain that you have from things that are far apart, is expected to fail. And indeed, when we go and look at a similar energy minimization using the screen potential, even if we start with something that is tight, it could open up, but not always, because there are still cases where even with screened Coulomb interaction, you create these tight objects. And actually, it is kind of simple to say physically what distinguishes one case from another case. Suppose you take a polymer, I guess this is not sufficiently stiff, but it serves the purpose, and I try to bend it. There's of course some amount of charge because the backbone has some stiffness in it. Now imagine that this thing was charged, it had charges all along it. As I bend it, I bring the charges closer to each other. So there's two contributions to the bending. One is from the backbone. If you have charges, even if there is screening in the environment, there is some contribution due to the Coulomb potential. And it turns out that in order to distinguish whether you would see one circumstance or the other, the question is which contribution to the bending is larger. As long as the Coulomb inter-air contribution to the bending is larger, you would get this. If the backbone contribution is larger, you would get this. And so we roughly think that for something like double-stranded DNA, which is quite stiff, this is going to be the case. But something like single-stranded DNA or RNA, which is less stiff, with sufficiently low amount of screening, you could create these kinds of local tight knot entities. And I won't go into this, but once you create these tight knot entities, of course, they will modify a lot of properties of how easy it is for the system to relax, because to relax, you have to get rid of these entanglements. But that's a talk for a different audience. Now, having given you an idea of why certain types of interactions, like Coulomb potentials, can give you tight objects, tight entanglements, I want to remove the interactions completely and try to convince you that entropy itself could also do something similar. Now, it is actually very hard for me to do that statement, justify that statement directly for Knot. So I'm going to take a step back and introduce a different artificial type of entanglement and convince you that that's the case for that artificial type of entanglement that that actually was introduced earlier by Ball, Edwards, and company. It's called a slip knot. So suppose that you have a polymer that is a ring, but then you insert onto it a belt buckle. So basically the polymer comes, goes through one hole of the belt buckle, goes around, comes and goes through the other hole of the belt buckle. But the belt buckle can slide along this circular piece of string, but cannot fall off. Okay? So you explore all possible configurations. Question is, where do you think this slip link is going to end up? You think it will be roughly in the middle, kind of. If you have the whole interval, maybe you would say it's roughly equally probable to be anywhere, and so on average in the middle. The answer is no, because each one of these segments, one of length s, one of length n minus s, if the total length of the circle is n, has to perform a closed walk that comes back to the origin. And there is an entropy associated with the number of ways that you can start at some point and walk around and come back to the origin, which for random walks, taking a walk of length s, that number of configuration falls off as 1 over s to the 3/2. It's essentially a closure constraint. So you have to close two loops, one of length s, one of length n minus s. And so the weight that you have as a function of s actually is least likely in the middle, and diverges after the cutoff that you have at the two ends. So my claim is that if you were to look at this Bell spectrum, it will actually be pushed to one corner because the big loop will gain a lot of room for entropy. Now you would say that, okay, this argument that you give was too hand-waving. Polymers actually are not like random walk. One can do better than that, put constraints of the fact that the walk cannot go over itself, avoiding. There is a whole machinery that one can apply. And essentially, the only thing that changes is that these exponents at the side, rather than being 3/2, change to something that is even steeper, something like 2.5. And so what happens is that it actually gets even tighter when you include self-avoiding constraints. Okay? So let's check some of these predictions about this slip link or figure 8. In one context, which is for what I will call flattened polymer knots. So you take a polymer in 3 dimension and have a surface that attracts it, so it basically gets absorbed on the surface. So now you have a polymer that is living in 2 dimensions. And you can, if you like, put a twist on it to make it into a figure 8. And let's say at the beginning, I will talk about simulations that we perform. So this is a simulation of one of these chains in 2 dimensions. And the 3 black dots that you can see here are the projection of this belt buckle or slip link. And this is a typical configuration that we generated after a while. You can see that there is a very short segment, 3 on one side, and there's a huge segment on the other. Of course, you can go and generate many configurations and look at the probability distribution for how many monomers you have on this tight side. And it's filed precisely with the exponent that we predicted on the basis of the self-avoiding box. And actually, Matt Hastings is also in this program. He was involved in an experiment at Los Alamos in which they didn't do a polymer. They just took a chain, a granular chain, real chain, put it on a surface, put a twist to make a figure 8, and shook it. And as they shook it, they sampled a lot of configurations. I have no idea whether these configurations are representative of equilibrium configurations. All I can tell you is that when they calculated the number of beads that are on one side and plotted the probability distribution, towards the end, it fits to exactly the same power law that we can get from theory and also from the simulation. Now I want to go to the case of real knots rather than this figure 8. So suppose I have a trefoil in 3 dimension that I flatten by absorbing onto the surface, then we know that it should have this minimal 3 crossings. And while it is in 2 dimension, I can very well characterize how tight it is because I have essentially 6 segments that are between these crossing points. And in the same way that when I had the figure 8, I had 2 segments, and the weight became concentrated on one of them being small and one of them being large, I can look at the behavior of the weight as a function of all 6 segments, and I find that the weight becomes concentrated on regions where a lot of these segment lengths go to 0. And this is very similar to sort of contractions that one could do in these theoretical diagrams. And Andrea Tanke sort of made the classification of how likely are the various shapes in which you have contracted many things. And indeed, the most likely shape that you would get is that 4 of these segments essentially go to 0. One of them is kind of intermediate, and one of them is very big. And the probability distribution for the length of this smaller one of the 2 is again the same one that one had for the figure 8. And one can again confirm that by the simulations of self-avoiding polymers with 2 dimensions. This was a trefoil, and all of the complexity becomes concentrated over here. One can calculate the number of beads that are involved in this entangled part, and satisfies this power law that we predict. And this is not only for the trefoil. Any complicated knot in 2 dimensions that we tried, also all of the complexity became kind of squeezed to one corner. And again, if we didn't have prime knots, but we had composite knots, the composite knots got factored by entropy to these two different elements. Now, what's shown here is a very recent experiment in which they took circularized DNA, but not necessarily in the form of a ring in three dimensions. And they had a process to absorb it onto a surface, and then they could image the DNA on the surface. And again, it's not clear exactly whether you are seeing here three dimensions, two dimensions, etc. But again, in the majority of the figures that you see basically one big piece that is without entanglement, and all of the entanglement gets squeezed to one corner. That's not known, whether or not when they actually bring this on two dimension, it's a frozen configuration from three dimension, or once it is on surface, it can relax. And in principle, if one could do sufficiently many of these and characterize the distribution law for the size of these segments, one could distinguish whether they are truly two dimension or not. So I guess this at 2007, what they did was they found a number of them. Okay? Okay, just briefly mention in context to what I will say later on, that one knows that polymers, if they are at high temperature, they're kind of swollen, they explore a lot of space. If you go to low temperature and there's any attraction between them, the attraction forces them to become compactified globules. And indeed, in two dimensions, we can repeat the analysis that we had both for swollen polymers and for the phase where they are compactified. And we find that when they are in the dense or compactified phase, this ordering of the different contractions does not take place. So whereas for dilute polymers, you had one big part and one small part, for dense polymers, if you have a knot, there is no entropic advantage to making it tight. So we will see some remnant of this leftover in three dimensions that I will come to later. This is some simulation by a different group that's supposed to show that. Okay. Now I want to talk about a couple of topics for which it is important that I make a disclaimer right up front. That the things that I'm going to tell you about from this point on don't really have nice mathematical definitions. Partly because I will be talking about open polymers, and there is the knot in an open polymer. If you tighten it, okay, you say it's there. But if it is kind of an open structure, for an open polymer, mathematicians would say it's not a well-defined quantity. The other quantity that is not well-defined is the size of the polymer. So when I was in two dimensions, I could identify the segment where all of the entanglement was taking place, count up all of the beads, and that was the size of my entangled segment. But if I'm in three dimension and everything is a three-dimensional curve, where does the knotted portion begin and end? Not so clear. So for those quantities, one has to sort of resort to operational definitions. The one definition that we used was obtained by pulling on knots. So in the extreme case, you could say, let's say I didn't know that I had a string that had knot in it or not, I would just pull it as much as possible. And just by knowing the difference between how much I can pull in one case and if it is a knot, I can pull less, I would know that there is a certain amount that became part of the knot entanglement. So that's the extreme. What we did was we applied this, not in the regime where things were maximally tight, but when things were open structures, such as the one that is over there, we still looked at the characteristics of force versus extension, and from those characteristics, try to deduce a difference between force extension curve of cases where there was no knot, and when there was a knot between them, And we saw that effectively one could relate the force extension curve without the knot to the cases that there did a knot, provided that we made a shortening of the number of monomers of the knot by a certain amount that we call the knot size. And indeed, in a number of cases, we try to even identify where the knot is, which is this white portion. So you can see that there is actually a distribution as you go and statistically sample the system. Sometimes this portion is more, sometimes it's big, etc. On average, we found that as we go to longer and longer polymers, the size of the knot also grew, but as a fraction of the whole thing, it was smaller. Very roughly, let's say that if you have a system of length n, the size of this entangled portion is of the order of square root of n. So you go to bigger polymers, it gets bigger, but as a fraction of the entire length of the polymer, it is smaller. Now, exactly what this exponent is, actually, I wouldn't say to know within 30% even, because our estimate for it was 0.4, and some other group went and did another study and got 0.8. And I'll show you another study of ours later on, a different system where we got 0.6. So this is another thing that, in principle, one can try to sort of explore further, confirm whether this picture is correct or not, and if so, what the exponent is. But again, it's kind of not very well defined what portion you assign to being part of the knot. So let me show you another method that we use. The problem is that you have a curve in three dimensions. It has lots of bends and twists, etc., and it kind of hides where the knotted portion is. If you could simplify it, it would work. And so there is one way of, many ways of simplifying it, but one way of simplifying things is, let's say you have this sequence of monomers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You take every triplet and you try to remove the one in the middle in the first pass number 2. If the triangle 1, 2, 3 doesn't enclose anything else, that's not going to change topology, so you can replace it with 1, 3. But say here the triangle that is 4, 5, 6, there's a part of the polymer that comes back and goes through it, so you can remove that. So you can continue with this process. And so this picture is supposed to show you an example of such a process. So this is a self-avoiding polymer configuration that is generated in three dimensions. Does anybody want to guess whether or not it has a knot? If so, where is the knot? Okay, so let's see what happens if we try to follow this simplification procedure. So gradually, the details are going to be smoothened out repeatedly through this process. You can see it becomes clearer and clearer as things goes on. Let's see what is happening. And not for all configuration. So this is a sort of specially chosen configuration. At the end of the process, you find that there's a long portion, and you can identify somewhere in the bottom there was a knot, and you can count the number of monomers that were originally between this point and that point, and use that as a definition of the size of the entanglement that you have. Okay? So we apply this procedure in order to sort of be somewhat more realistic to a model of a polymer that is supposed to be, it's developed in the group of Kurt Binder, and it's supposed to be a very good representation of polyethylene, which is the simplest type of polymer that you can have. And what we simulated were polymers that for real polyethylene would be up to length 3,000 monomers. And what we find is that as long as you are in the phase that you have at high temperature, where the polymer wants to be explore the entropic space and is swollen, most of the time it gets reduced to nothing. It doesn't have any entanglement. But when you go to low temperatures, so that the polymer is into a compact globular shape, then when you apply this procedure, most of the time it comes to have a knot. And to quantify this roughly, for this length polyethylene, which is 3,000, In the swollen phase, roughly 1% of the configurations have enough in them. In the compactified phase, 80% of them have enough in them. Now, in this phase, if you do get enough, it's actually kind of small in size, and the exponent that we found in this study was something like n to the 0.6 rather than n to the 0.4. But when you are in this phase, the knot is all over the place. So basically, here we can see that in the globular phase, the size of the knot is roughly linearly the size of the polymer, whereas in the coil phase, it goes sublinear. Again, these exponents, I don't really have too much faith in, but this question of whether or not it is linear or sublinear, I think is correct. Okay, so polyethylene is the simplest type of synthetic polymer. And of course, there are biopolymers. Experiments for DNA that is in good solution confirms this picture, because DNA in good solution would be more like this swollen phase. And for something that is of the order of 10,000 base pairs of DNA, few percent of the configurations are found to be knotted. So that would be one example of a swollen phase, although again, to what extent that is relevant to DNA in the cell, because in the cell DNA is going to be compactified, wrapped around histones, et cetera. That I'm not claiming that this number has any biological significance. On the other hand, we did look for knots in another subset of biologically interesting polymers, which are proteins. There is a database called Protein Database PDB that has a lot of protein configuration structures listed. There are roughly some 34,000, 35,000 by now. And you can go and apply this program to all of the elements in the structure, and you find that roughly 1% of them, actually less than 1%, 273, let's say, out of this number, when we first look at 2007, are knotted. And we actually, as a service, we decided to develop a web server that each of you can access. And if you have some favorite proteins, you can give its coordinates or its name. And okay. I thought I did have connection. I'm not connected to internet. How do I get the first page here? Okay, fine. So anyway, if the program will give you if it has a knot, and then if there's a biologist notice there's a J-more representation of the proteins that you can use to look at your protein. But let's just look at it turns out that actually there are only 6 or 7. So I said that there are roughly 280, 300 proteins that have knots in them. But many of them are repetition. It's the same thing calculated from different species, et cetera. So when you look at it more carefully, there were just a few families of proteins that have knots in them. There's something called alpha beta knots. There's carbonic anhydrases that exist in a lot of species because they are involved in CO2-2O2 cycle. And this and many others, they have essentially the simplest form of knot, the trefoil knot. And you can sort of look at the length of the polymer, the portion of the protein where the knot occurs, et cetera. It was also known that there are a couple of examples of square knots. But as of when we did our study, nobody had seen anything further than that. And then we found it in 2007, we found this object, ubiquity in hydrolase, that had the most complicated knot, which in projection is a 5 crossing entity. I should also note that finding knots for proteins is much less ambiguous than finding knots in these random polymers that I drew, for the following reason: that practically in all cases for proteins, they are roughly globular structures. The endpoints are on the surface, so you can see here there's an endpoint here, there's an endpoint here. So you can grab the two endpoints that are on the surface, fold them, connect them to infinity, and there's an unambiguous closing. If the two ends were inside, then you would have problem, because if you take rays that go to infinity, connect them, etc., you will be crossing other paths, and you could create as not artificial. That doesn't happen for these proteins 99% of the time, roughly. So we identified this. So it turns out that at this stage, it was very useful for us to have a collaborator, Leonid Mernin, who has spent a lot of time looking at proteins. So each one of these proteins that were tagged by our program, he looked at individually, made sure that there was no mistake, what it meant, etc. So when we looked at this, we eventually came up with a potential scenario as to why you have this kind of knot structure. So at this point, I have to tell you speculation that is more in the form of story. So this is a protein that's also present in humans. And what ubiquity in hydrolase means is that it is removing ubiquitin. And what ubiquitin is the marker for destruction of other proteins. So you have lots of proteins in your body. Once they sort of reach the end of their usefulness, they get degraded so that the amino acids can be used, etc. And the way there's a machinery in the cell called the proteasome that destroys proteins. And it is kind of like a barrel-shaped entity, where one end of the protein is put into this barrel and it's pulled through. And then it gets chopped off and decomposed. Now, this machinery, the proteasome, does not indiscriminately attack and destroy proteins. It attacks proteins that have been marked for destruction by addition of its ubiquitin. So ubiquitin is a marker that indicates that this particular protein has to be destroyed. Now, I guess the cell sometimes makes mistakes, and so there are proteins that are marked by ubiquitin that are not, they have to be get a reprieve or whatever, and this ubiquitin hydrolase is like a governor, comes and gives the reprieve by removing the ubiquitin that is attached to this protein. So our hypothesis was that because its job is to remove ubiquitin from other proteins, it is itself in the vicinity potentially marked by ubiquitin, and hence a target for being destroyed by the proteasome. And that maybe having this knotted structure is a way for it to achieve stability, in the sense that when the proteasome tries to grab it from one end or the other and pull it through, the knot gets tighter and resists it being pulled through. Now, there are other mechanisms that cells, proteins have to become more robust and less susceptible to destruction, like disulfide bonds, more stronger chemical bonds, etc. But all of those mechanisms would also make the protein less flexible. This protein has to be flexible because it's thought that the way that it does remove ubiquitin is that there is this part of it that is kind of like a lasso, goes over to the other side, grabs the ubiquitin, and pulls it through. So maybe having a knot is a good compromise to have both flexibility and stability at the same time. So we are hoping that some biologists, actually at MIT, the machinery, the proteasome, has been separated out, and so they can actually feed different proteins to it and see how easy it is for them to be destroyed. We'll see if this is a hard protein to destroy or not.
So, or you could just make mutants and see if the mutants survive. Mutants that don't have an arm.
That brings me to the next part, which is it's extremely hard to find what you would do to the sequence of a protein so that you would go from a structure that has a knot to one that doesn't have a knot, and yet it maintains a lot of its function and things like that. So we were again fortunate to identify another pair, which is something called transcarbamylase. Again, it turns out that if you identify proteins that are serving the same function in different species, they have the same structure. If one of them has not, they all have not. Except for this particular transcambrase, transcarbamylase, that we found that in most species, it did have a knot, and in one species, it did not have a knot. And the substrate, all of these knotted proteins, by the way, are enzymes, so they deal with some substrate or other. So the substrate that it deals with is different for the two cases. And what we identified was that what had happened to give one of them knot and not knot to the other was that there was a segment of length 18 amino acids that had been inserted into one of them, allowing it to have a larger loop of flexibility that would go over the other. So if you want to do the experiment that you have in mind, how easy it is to sort of fold something that has a knot or not, this would be the candidate because the proteins are otherwise very similar to each other. Now, this was in 2007, and then this website that I showed you basically on a weekly basis was sending us emails whenever new structures were submitted to the protein database. It would automatically look at new knots, et cetera, and send us emails. And then at some point it became silent and each one of us had our own problems, so we didn't really pursue it. And it turned out that there was some incompatibility in the data structures, et cetera. So at some point a few months ago, the postdoc Peter Bernau, who had done this, came back and restarted it, and then suddenly we had a few hundred structures that were submitted in 2008, and we found two interesting things. One of which was the shortest protein that has a knot in it, it's a trefoil, not surprisingly, only 92 amino acids. This protein has not been classified, so it doesn't fall anywhere in the table that I showed you originally. Nobody knows what it does. And then we came across another surprise, something that has six crossings in projection, which is now the most complicated knot discovered today. And this is in an entity called the halogenase, whose job it is that apparently there are some chemical weights that have fluorine and chlorine in it, and this entity can chop them off, chop the halogen off. It presumably would have some use in removing waste. But one of the questions is, well, it's a complicated thing. How should it ever fold? And so I guess Leonid Mernin had the following idea. He went and colored the piece of rope starting from one end to the other end, et cetera, according to the structure of this protein. And then notice that actually, if you take one side of the loop, expand it, and you put it over the other, then it very easily disentangles. So despite having something like six crossings, one can sort of project a potential folding scenario for this. So we thought it was interesting and submitted it to some journals, but I don't think they like this picture. So let me go and summarize. So I sort of started by telling you that basically knots have been a constant source of fascination and mystery in art, nature, and science. And a lot of physicists have played with this and found interesting results starting from Tate, Thomson, Maxwell, etc. Now, for real proteins, you are not interested, real polymers, you may be interested in properties other than topological, but how these entanglements modify things. And one of the things that you would therefore need to know is where the entanglement is physically, something that has no mathematical relevance. And I hope I convinced you that for the charge knots, the Coulomb interaction can tighten the knot, and that in other cases, entropy considerations could also lead to the same effect. For the case of open polymers, we sort of define effective sizes using procedures such as pulling on things. And in general, as far as statistical ensembles of random polymers are concerned, the overall message is that when you are in the swollen phase, knots are few and tight. If you are in the globular compact phase, knots are abundant and loose or large. But somehow, those ensembles have nothing to do with globular proteins, where on the basis of statistics, you would have guessed that there would be lots and lots of knots, but in reality, there are few, because clearly they are not a random ensemble, evolution, foldability, et cetera. You can have your own hypothesis, have made knots very rare in proteins. And I guess I mentioned a lot of my collaborators, Paul Domerson, Josh Metzler, Andreas Hanke, Jakob Cantor did a lot of this with me, Odette Farago, who was here at CPSC, Roya Gandhi, who's currently here, Peter Bernard did a lot of the protein work, and Kolesov was setting up this website, and Leonid Verney really understood the proteins and made sure that we are doing things right. There is support from MSF. Now, just a footnote here. When I submitted my abstract, then Tony Z wrote me an email, very politely and not explicitly, but implicitly said, this is too boring. You have to say something exciting and controversial. So I added a sentence at the beginning of the abstract regarding Ig Nobel Prizes. So I have to, I guess, stoke that controversy. The statement is that the Ig Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded for spontaneous knotting of an agitated finger. What the hell happened here? Yeah. Let's try one of them. Okay. Okay, so this is the paper that was published, and it has some nice figures that show you that if you take a rope, a string, and you put it in a box, and then shake it, then they actually go to the trouble of calculating Alexander polynomials. I don't know why, but they find that it becomes knotted. Now, I guess, as I said, Tony Z wanted controversy, so let's discuss whether there could be others that should have gotten this prize. There was, I mentioned to you the work of Ben Naim et al., where they do this granular chain. So they actually did granular chain experiments with trefoil knots, and they shook it and they looked at the dynamics of how it becomes unknotted. So maybe that was a potential candidate. And actually, this is a very nice work by Taylor about proteins. And they conducted an unbiased estimate for how many proteins should have knots by taking the meter length of Christmas decorations, cover the end beads in blue tack, and pour the beads from hand to hand. When the two end beads eventually stick together, check for knots. In an unscientifically sampled small sample, 20 tries, one quarter of these proteins were knotted. So again, this is why question of knots being rare in protein. So especially in an August setting such as CITP, I'm sure there have been discussions about Nobel Prizes and who deserves it and who is not. I hope this is the first case where Ig Nobel Prizes have been such discussed. Yes. That's a very good question. So you want us to identify for each one of these structures, we have the part that is supposed to be the knotted part, and compare it. Yeah, we haven't done that. No, but that's a correlation between them. Yeah, whether it's just structural or it's part of the function. Yeah, I think. The only thing that I can say is that in this particular case, where the muted version didn't have a knot, the substrate also had changed. The enzyme was. Yes. Okay. So there's a number of answers to that. One of which is that looking at knots in proteins is relatively new subject, and I guess we picked them because we had the procedures to find knots. There are a few experiments, at least there's only one actually I know, where there was a protein that was known to have a knot was shown to fall without need for chaperones. There are coming up a number of simulation studies by Shachnovich, by other groups, where they simulate these proteins using standard models that you may or may not believe in, and then some fraction of them do form the native structure. In particular, I mentioned to you that our hand-over-hand knot procedure was rejected, that paper. So we went and found somebody who does simulations. And indeed, in simulation, some of the trajectories fall precisely as we would have predicted by this hand-over-hand method. So there are some indications that these things do manage to fold into these complicated knotted structures, but probably that's not the norm, because if it was the norm, you would expect many more of them. Maybe that's part of it.